This is the Heart of Life Pounding.
Iraqi media say arrest warrants have been issued for several participants in a conference in the northern city of Erbil on the normalization of ties with Israel. Iran sends another consignment of humanitarian aid to its war-ravaged neighbor, Afghanistan. And thousands of Tunisians take to the streets in the capital, Tunis, to voice their anger at President Kais Saied's power grab in July. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. First story this hour takes us to Iraq, which has issued arrest warrants for several people participating in a Friday conference in Erbil that backed the normalization of ties with Israel. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed that issue with our guests. Let's take a listen.
On this edition of the program, Iraq's Supreme Judicial Council has reportedly issued arrest warrants for several participants of a conference in the northern city of Erbil on normalization of ties with Israel. Iraqi media said the council issued warrants for three people and pledged to target others as soon as they are identified. According to the reports, the council called the participation in the conference a crime. Earlier, the Kurdistan Regional Government said the conference was neither authorized nor approved by local officials. The KRG said the issues discussed in the conference do not reflect the views and policies of the Iraqi Kurdistan region. Prominent Iraqi figures, including the country's president and prime minister, have already slammed the conference as illegal. 300 people took part in the event organized by U.S. think tank on Friday. They called for normalization of ties between Iraq and Israel. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have Mr. Masoud Shajada from the Islamic Human Rights Commission, who's joining us from the British capital, London. Also, we have journalist and political analyst Mr. Elijah Magnier, who's joining us from Brussels. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Shajada in London. First of all, give us your thoughts on this conference.
Well, this is the sort of the activities that the Zionists do to create the environment for normalization and the expansion of their colonial power in the region and beyond. And the fact of the matter is there is, on one side, we need to oppose this because of the injustices that is taking place in occupied Palestine and the fact that this is... this is a illegal occupation, a brutal apartheid system, and is damaging not just the Palestinians, but anyone who stands against this brutal and illegal apartheid system. But I think another side is the fact that, you know, this level of apartheid, this level of racism, which we see day in, day out in Israel, showing its ugly head by people abusing anyone other than Jewish community, and in particular the Arabs, the way that they are actually abusing them in their demonstrations and so forth. It is really incredible. Anyone will want to extend that to their country and their region. And I think there has to be vigilance to try to stop it.
Mr. Magnier, what are your thoughts on this conference that took place? It has already received a lot of condemnation and has been slammed by officials in Iraq and the Iraqi Kurdistan region.
Thank you for having me. I think this is a very serious issue. First of all, the UK location of the conference that took place in the very in the vicinity of the presidential palace, of the parliament, of the prime minister base, and it is impossible for 300 people to meet in one place in that particular sensitive, security sensitive area without the knowledge of the Kurdistan regional authority. Secondly, this is not new, the presence of the Israelis and Zionists in the area of Kurdistan and their operation on the ground. So what we can't understand is we have the clear position from the president, who is a Kurdish, Barham Saleh, the speaker, who is Sunni, Halbousi, Muhammad al-Habousi, and the prime minister, who is a Shia, Prime Minister al-Kazimi, who all three condemned this meeting. However, we don't see anything in the constitution that imposing on Kurdistan the same policy that the Iraqi government is adopting and preventing the access of Israel to the Kurdistan-Iraqi area that is part of Iraq. Therefore, what's happening in Kurdistan is extremely worrying and causes high concern. This attempt to normalize with Israel that we have seen in 2017 referendum, when the Kurdish semi-autonomous region wanted to declare independence from an independent state from Iraq, and Israel was the only entity that was supporting the Kurds from splitting from Iraq. And we see this happening. This is very serious, because there were tribes from Al-Anbar in the western Iraq. There were other people representing the government from the education ministry. And it's the people in the conference were in connection with Israel, where the son of Shimon Peres was also presenting his take on it and greeting the people in the conference. So Israel will totally fail to normalize with Iraq, because Iraq will never normalize with Israel. However, this is not going to stop the Israeli from attempting to do so, notwithstanding the fact that those who promoted the Abraham Agreement, and we're talking here about Benjamin Netanyahu, Jared Kushner, and President Donald Trump, are gone. So this attempt to continue normalizing with Israel will continue, but the West Asia and Middle Eastern country should be very aware and attentive of this attempt.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Masoud Shajara from the Islamic Human Rights Commission in London. And also thanks to journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier joining us from Brussels. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review.
Well, Muslim pilgrims are marching towards Iraq's holy city of Karbala to mark Arba'in, the largest annual gathering in the world. The pilgrims are converging on the city to observe the 40th day after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the grandson of Prophet Muhammad. This year, Arba'in falls on September the 28th. Prior to the pandemic, the event drew tens of millions each year, but now the Iraqi government has restricted the number of foreign pilgrims. The visitors are restricted, and most of them actually are Iranians this year. Imam Hussein and dozens of his companions were martyred during the Battle of Karbala with the tyrant of that time over 13 centuries ago. They were killed on the day of Ashura. Meanwhile, another consignment of Iranian humanitarian assistance has arrived in Afghanistan. That's the third batch of aid Iran has sent to its eastern neighbor in recent days. Well, the help comes amid UN warnings of a looming humanitarian catastrophe in Afghanistan. For more on that, our correspondent Amin Alami joined us early from the Kabul International Airport, where the Iranian aid had landed.
According to officials, I mean Iranian and Taliban officials here at Kabul International Airport, this flight is carrying 15 tons of humanitarian aid to the people of Afghanistan, including food and medicine. In the meantime, officials here say that Afghanistan needs more humanitarian aid, especially from its neighboring countries, because according to Taliban officials, the U.S. has proved to be not honest with the people of Afghanistan over the past 20 years, and even it abandoned Afghanistan, the people of Afghanistan, by putting more sanctions on this country. In the meantime, many have believed that while Afghanistan and its people are facing a real economic crisis and poverty and joblessness are also on the rise in this country, dispatching of such humanitarian aid by Iran, Afghanistan's Western neighbor, the Islamic Republic of Iran, has created hope and optimism about the real will of the Afghan people, the Afghan government under the rule of the Taliban, in order to boost its ties and relations with such countries who are truly supporting the people of Afghanistan during difficult days they are experiencing.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi says sanctions cannot hinder the development of Iran's relations and cooperation with other countries. Raisi described as cruel and illegal the embargoes imposed on Iran over its nuclear energy program. He said the sanctions have created some problems but will never hamper Iran's progress. President Raisi said imposing sanctions on Iran is completely unjustified. That's because, he said, numerous reports by the International Atomic Energy Agency have verified the peaceful nature of Iran's nuclear activities. The Iranian president was speaking with Austria's new ambassador to Tehran at a meeting to receive his credentials. Wolf Dietrich Heim said Iran and Austria should take steps to strengthen bilateral relations. U.S. sanctions are known to cause economic paralysis, but the sanctions regime policy against other countries by respective American administrations has also inflicted a terrible human toll. A new report by the Sanctions Kill Coalition has outlined the deadly impact and global condemnation of U.S. measures.
In recent decades, the United States has increasingly used sanctions as an instrument of foreign policy. There are different types of sanctions: economic or financial restrictions, trade prohibitions, and blocking or seizing assets of individuals, organizations, and countries. Now, a coalition of North American human rights organizations, named the Sanctions Kill Coalition, has released a report on the impacts of the U.S. sanctions on other countries and their people. Whether direct or indirect, most of the U.S. sanctions are not authorized by the United Nations Security Council, and many of them are imposed unilaterally by Washington. In fact, more than two-thirds of the world's countries officially condemn U.S. sanctions as a blatant violation of international law and the UN Charter. The report has also revealed a bitter reality that Western media rarely or never talk about. One finding is that U.S. sanctions are hurting the most vulnerable and driving middle-class citizens into poverty. Also, they have resulted in thousands of deaths and humanitarian exemptions. For instance, U.S. sanctions on the Syrian Central Bank have collapsed the country's currency, sending millions of civilians into grinding poverty. Also, waiving sanctions by the U.S. undermine countries' capacity to respond to the coronavirus pandemic, resulting in loss of lives. The inhumane sanctions cause difficulty for countries like Iran to obtain medical supplies, sanitation equipment, and other necessary goods to slow the virus spread. Therefore, the U.S. contributed to many unnecessary deaths in Iran.
So we've actually known for 100 years, at least a century, what the impact is. The impact is primarily felt by the civilian population, and it is devastating.
The report also says many U.S. sanctions are based on false claims of an emergency and a threat to national security.
Now to Tunisia, where thousands of people in the capital have protested against President Kais Saied's power grab in July. Demonstrators gathered in Tunis under heavy police presence. They carried banners reading "The Constitution is a red line." Protesters called on President Saeed to step down. This week, he brushed aside much of the Constitution, giving himself power to rule by decree. Saeed did so 2 months after he sacked the prime minister, suspended parliament, and assumed executive authority. Opponents have accused him of staging a coup. However, the president insists that he aims to address Tunisia's political paralysis and economic crisis. Alame Hassan Hassanzadeh Amoni, a renowned Iranian religious scholar, has passed away at the age of 93. He was an acclaimed figure in the fields of Islamic philosophy, science, and humanities. Now, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has extended his condolences for the demise of Hassanzadeh Amoni. More in the following report.
Iranians are mourning the demise of Allame Hassan Hassanzadeh Amoli, a prominent Shia theologian, philosopher, mathematician, and mystic. He passed away at the age of 93 after a period of hospitalization for heart diseases. Condolences poured in from top personalities, including the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution. In his message, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei hailed Allame as a rare gem whose teachings would continue to inspire lovers of wisdom. President Ebrahim Raisi also described him as a skilled and holistic intellectual who educated famed students and left a brilliant and fruitful record. Allame Hassanzadeh was born to a religious family in Iran's northern city of Amol in 1929. He spent his early life there and received theological education, but later moved to Tehran to expand his studies at the famous Marvi Seminary and other schools. In 1963, he settled in the holy city of Qom, where he studied Islamic philosophy with pioneer figures, including Allama Sayyid Muhammad Hussein Tabatabai, one of the most prominent thinkers of modern Shia Islam. Allama Hassanzadeh spent the rest of his life teaching at the Islamic Seminary of Qom and writing numerous books. He was a figure who had mastery not only over Islamic philosophy and theology, but skilled in other fields as well. He was largely influenced by Muslim philosophers such as Avicenna, Mulla Sadr, and Al-Arabi, whose perspectives can be seen in his works and teachings. Due to vast knowledge in science and humanities, Allame Hassanzadeh was nicknamed Zulfunun, meaning polymath. An advocate of philosophy, he was opposed to the traditional resistance against its teaching at Shia seminaries and rejected the belief that the Islamic philosophy had its roots in ancient Greek philosophy. Nearly 190 books and treatises on philosophy, jurisprudence, mysticism, traditional medicine, mathematics, astronomy, and Persian and Arabic literature are testimonies of Allame Hassanzadeh's universal prominence and a legacy that will continue to generate innovative scholarship.
And with that, it brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Simple Life. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Regarding the duties of one who owns blessings, which means everyone who is breathing, Imam Ridha alayhi salam, the 8th infallible Imam, said, there are certain duties for one who owns blessings. Paying the alms tax, helping his believing brothers, visiting the relations of kin, providing the means of comfort for his family, etc. Then he said, "Sometimes I receive a blessing but cannot enjoy it unless I know I have fulfilled what is incumbent upon me regarding it." Brothers and sisters, if we learn to live simply, as our Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam did, we will be successful. Those simple acts of life, like visiting family or helping a believing brother, are things that some of us do not do. It is our duty. It is our responsibility. And how can we enjoy all our other blessings like wealth, enough food, a home, car, etc., when we cannot even perform a simple act of such? You know, these actions, these prescriptions, they have been provided to us by Prophet and Ahlul Bayt for a reason. Quran talks about them for a reason. They're supposed to give us a meaningful life. These attributes and these values, you know, for instance, right now, we see the COVID is widespread. If we are selfish and we're not helping anyone out there, then this is not in accordance with the Islamic lifestyle. Yes, be precautious, but that does not translate to becoming selfish. There's a fine line, and we'll discuss this after the break. Welcome back, dear listeners. We've been discussing simple life, and we went over a few values that Imam Ridha alayhi salam, the 8th infallible Imam, has provided to us. And we said if we start to implement all of these, if not all in the beginning, maybe a few of these in our lives, we will start to see that positive change taking place in our lives. Now, you know, when we look at, for instance, you know, families suffering from this COVID coronavirus patients, right? We have to be very careful about our health. It is something which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has held us responsible for. But at the same time, we know that we have socio-political responsibilities. We owe the society, we owe other believers. We have to take care of them. We have to be nice to them. We have to be a helping hand. Anyways, this may be one of the reasons why we cannot enjoy our simple blessings of life. For instance, let's take rain again. I like to use this rain as an example because I notice when it rains, people complain. Why? Well, the question is, why do you complain? The Quran says that rain is a blessing. But to people these days, rain is bad because it makes their car dirty, their shoes and pants wet, and it causes traffic. If you ask a brother or sister living in Somalia, for instance, where almost half the people survive on only 3 cups of water a day, they take the rain as a blessing. It's a simple blessing in life Allah has given us. Do you ever wonder why in some of the pictures that are taken in third world countries, the people, no matter what they are wearing or how bad their hair look or where they are, you know, their locality, they smile the most beautiful smiles because they realize, Alhamdulillah, we are alive. Going back to the rain example, they enjoy every drop of the rain. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Aperture.
Welcome back, everyone. In the first part, we saw how in 1951, inhabitants of a French village were suddenly tormented by terrifying hallucinations. At least 7 people died, dozens were taken to a local asylum, and hundreds were affected. Immediately, wild theories started emerging to explain this mysterious case of mass insanity. There were claims of poisoned flour, contaminated water, and even witchcraft. The truth was stranger than any of these theories. The Central Intelligence Agency had spiked the local food with LSD as part of a mind control experiment at the height of the Cold War. And with time, U.S. government's interest in LSD shifted from a defensive to an offensive orientation. While the initial experiments with LSD were fairly simple, if shockingly unethical, over time these LSD experiments grew increasingly elaborate. Stay with us as victims reveal the naked truth in the next part of this program.
Entire populations bore the consequence of large-scale tests. Here are some examples. Again, uncontested cases that are recognized by the American government. In 1953, radioactive iodine was injected into newborns and pregnant women at Iowa University and also in Nebraska. In 1955, the CIA sprayed whooping cough bacteria off the coast of Tampa. 2 died and dozens fell ill. Also in 1955, the CIA enlisted prostitutes in San Francisco, opened 2 brothels and tested drugs on the clients, then filmed through a one-way mirror. In 1956, the Army released millions of mosquitoes carrying yellow fever and dengue on the towns of Savannah and Avon. There were several deaths and hundreds of people infected. In 1960, in Cincinnati, the Army financed a radiation program on 90 destitute or ill inhabitants of the city's University Hospital. Some died after several weeks. In 1966, the Army tested a virus in the New York Metro, then in Chicago. The bacteria was concealed in electric bulbs. The aim was to study the spread of chemical agents on a large scale. For these experiments, the Army or the CIA funded laboratories in the most prestigious universities, Yale, Stanford, Harvard, or Columbia. They all took part. Glorified by the idea of working for the nation's defense, the researchers went crazy.
Dr. Kligman in Philadelphia increases a dosage 468 times, which actually frightened Dow Chemical. They couldn't believe that a respected doctor would do that. In Washington, D.C., you had Walter Freeman, who was a very, very well-known lobotomist who traveled around the country doing lobotomies in his car. And he would use an ice pick. He could do 15 to 20 in a day. It was just incredible what some doctors did, and very few, if any, people in the hospital or the medical community blew the whistle on it. It really was an egregious act, and it showed that the medical community was more interested in protecting its ass than in protecting the test subject and the patients, because a lot of doctors went off the deep end and started doing things that are just inconceivable now.
To express his indignation, Alan Hornblum wrote half a dozen books. A former prison guard at Holmesburg in Pennsylvania, from his first day at work over 40 years ago, he had a horrible shock.
I was stunned to see scores of inmates with their shirts off, strapped and wrapped in bandages and gauze tape, and I couldn't imagine that I was going into an atmosphere that was that violent, because all of the men looked like they had just walked a cell block knife fight.
They explain that it's not because of any violence, but experiments that are carried out there. Alan was the first to denounce this scandal and would lose his job as a result.
It was probably the largest human experimentation factory in America, possibly the world. From 51 until 1974, more people were probably incorporated in more experiments than any other place in the world.
Drugs, viruses, cancerous cells, plutonium, sarin gas. The most toxic products were tested in Holmesburg, but also in dozens of prisons throughout the country. To condemn these experiments, Alan Hornblum found former inmates like Youssef. In 1961, this man was imprisoned for selling marijuana. He was poor, with limited education. He was offered a chance to take part in tests for a dollar a day. Since then, Youssef has had his digestive tract operated on. He has liver and skin problems and can no longer work. His first test was for a bath foam from the company Johnson & Johnson.
They took tape and they stuck it on your back and pulled it off, stuck it on and pulled it off until the first layer of skin came off your back. And they put six sections on my back like that. And then they took a bottle with the Johnson & Johnson bubble bath and put it on a patch and put the patch over the raw area. Then they took a can. I recognized that can as being from the Army. And I was like, what Johnson got to do with this? So he took the can and he sprayed it on my back. And when it hit my back, it was cold. But it was so toxic, and like fumes, I could taste it in my mouth. And as I'm walking down, I'm getting dizzier and dizzier, dizzier and dizzier. By the time I stepped into my cell, I passed out. Boom, and my back was inflamed. And by the time I woke up that morning, I had great big blisters on my back full of pus. This rash just gets worse and worse. And it looks like when the moon come out at night, it flames up. And I'd be moaning and crying. My cell partners couldn't sleep. Goes over there, a little shot cup, and it looked like water. We drinks it. Everything became magnified, the sound, like the loudspeaker on the system. Ooh, ooh, ooh. The walls look like they turned into water. You know what I mean? And like I spent the whole time like looking around like this here instead of doing the test. So I go back to the block in that condition, and man, I mean, I was tripping, and it was like a slow-acting drug that was in that cup. It lasts for weeks. The inmates start naming me Outer Limits. I had no conversation for nobody. I was scared of the inmates, and the inmates act like they was afraid of me.
What you had were hundreds and hundreds of uneducated minorities, overwhelmingly black and Puerto Rican, and then you had white doctors with white lab coats with PhD or MD after their name, and it was a recipe for abuse, if not disaster. And those prison walls are an ideal spot to do controversial experiments, because just as those walls keep the inmates in, they also keep the public out, so no one finds out about it.
Prisoners were used, but also patients. In certain hospitals, patients were steered towards the services financed by the CIA. These services carried out limitless experiments on psychological manipulation. In 1965, Karen Wetmore was only 13 when she was admitted to a hospital in Vermont. She stayed there several times in her childhood. She suffered from severe depression after falling victim to a pedophile neighbor. Admitted against her will, she was not allowed any contact with her family, being told that it was for her own good.
The CIA was specifically looking for children between the ages of 13 and 18 to further dissociate. They wanted dissociative children. There's a sense of absolute and total helplessness. You're there, you're bound up, you're locked in this room. No matter how you scream, no matter what you say, no one is going to come. It does something to you, something you don't get over.
The doctors went to work on Karen. They wanted to erase her memory and create a robot at their command. It took 30 years of legal battles for Karen to obtain her medical records and discover the violence of the treatments she was subjected to.
It says seclusion, full cam. A cam is a straitjacket. And ties, which means they tied my arms and they tied my feet. This goes on uninterrupted, day after day, week after week, February, March, April, right up until June 21st, 1971. You sleep on the floor. On the floor, no blanket, no nothing. And my arms were secured like this, behind my back. I do remember that. It's extremely painful because it pulls on your neck, pulls on your shoulder. You can't get away from it. It's maddening is what it is, maddening. And I was naked. And I think that was part of the effort of that experiment to break me down. Everything they did was to break me down.
Months in a confined room with no bearings, while her captors administered all kinds of drugs and sometimes electric shocks at inhuman levels.
Number of shocks and the seconds that they held the shocks. They had 30, 30, 35, 35, 35, and they held it for sustained for 40 seconds. A normal shock would be a second. Certainly not 30 and 35 of them. One, not that many, which probably is what obliterated my memory right there. And I think that's why they did it. They also said, in this treatment right here, no seizure, shock restarted. So they gave me a second one because they couldn't produce a seizure. So they must have done it over again. They must have repeated it. It's unforgivable. And I'm sure I wasn't the only one they did this to. I'm sure. I survived to be able to talk about it.
How many suffered similar experiments? In Montreal, Canada, the CIA used a world-renowned psychiatrist to set up a factory of guinea pigs in the Allen Memorial Psychiatric Department in McGill University. This psychiatrist was Ewan Cameron, one of the all-powerful presidents of the World Psychiatric Association. In 1945, Ewan Cameron made the acquaintance of Rudolf Hess, one of the Nazis accused in the Nuremberg trial. In 1957, the CIA recruited him for their MK-Ultra program. The Americans wanted to perfect their interrogation techniques and program a human to kill. Ewan Cameron became the mad dog of psychiatry. He put his patients in vegetative states for several weeks while bombarding them with pre-recorded orders. Some would become incontinent, amnesiac, forgetting even who their parents were and how to speak. The Vermont hospital where Karen Wetmore was confined was working on the same program. In the hands of the CIA doctors, she was like a rag doll.
They used drugs like LSD. They used electric shock. They used chemical shock agent metrazole, which I was given in 1971. And I found that out in my medical records, which is a very brutal drug, very brutal drug. CIA said it was excruciating, physically and emotionally, excruciating drug. I have a quote from the CIA that said that the Soviets used it in the gulags, and that a POW would say or do anything to avoid a second dose. Nice drug.
There's all kinds of people who believe and people who don't believe, and that's a debate about do you believe or don't believe. I'm always interested in what are in the documents saying. So the documents clearly describe implanting electrodes in people's brains, activating the electrode from a remote transmitter, and changing the person's behavior from angry, pounding the wall, sitting there just staring.
Behind Karen's ear is a scar, and she doesn't know what it's from.
Once my therapist really understood that I had really been experimented on by the CIA, she said to me, you know, just for the heck of it, let me look. Because we'd read about, there's been information about these implants. And I'm like, okay. And it was there, actually there. I showed you. I went to a plastic surgeon who told me it was a surgical scar, but there's nothing in my medical history, nothing in a medical record that shows any kind of problem ever behind my right ear, or any incision or any surgery or anything else. But there it is.
What stopped the journey down this destructive path? In 1973, while Watergate is rattling all the institutions, Richard Helms, director of the CIA, feels the winds of change. He works as a lone wolf and hasn't informed the president of these experiments. He knows he's crossed the line. To protect himself, he orders the destruction of all documents relating to the MKUltra program and its abandonment. 2 years later, in 1975, the president Gerald Ford orders an inquiry into the CIA. The Rockefeller Commission is sworn in. The task isn't simple, because at the heart of the CIA, even Richard Helms' close lieutenants know nothing about the brainwashing programs.
There's a lot of goofy things go on in a big agency like that with all that secrecy. Things can go on that you don't know about, that the people who are working for the director most closely don't know about, or that the director doesn't know about. I mean, they're keeping it quiet down there. You know, don't tell anybody. If it works, then we'll tell them. But, you know, in the meantime, don't get into any difficulties. I remember when they wanted to take a kitty cat and stick a microphone up its rear end and put an antenna on its ear and have him walk in where we spy in the park with another one, walk over and walk around and listen in on it. You know, they tried it one time in an experiment, and a taxi came by and ran over the cat. You know, so.
In reality, nothing is funny. In its haste to get rid of evidence, the CIA forgets 20,000 documents. A drop of water compared to the amount that was destroyed, but they reveal that it financed 149 programs, implicating 80 institutions, including the most respected. Called on to justify themselves, the heads of the CIA, like Dr. Lashbrook, lie and downplay the facts.
There was, of course, claims or thoughts that maybe great things could be done with hypnosis. One small project in which we had a hypnotist do some experiments, primarily to see what the limitations of hypnosis might be. Can you make a person do something under hypnosis that he would not ordinarily do?
Even if the head of the CIA, Richard Helms, tried to minimize the scale of the experiments, the victims' testimonies contradict him.
The next thing I remember,
the inquiry commissions follow, each reaching more and more witnesses, like this woman, Chris DeNicola. Her father put her in the hands of a reputed CIA doctor, Dr. Green, when she was 12 years old.
His objective was to gain control of my mind and train me to be a spy assassin. Dr. Green had electrodes on my body, including my head. He used what looked like an overhead projector and repeatedly said he was burning different images into my brain while a red light flashed aimed at my forehead. In between each sequence, he used electric shock on my body and told me to go deeper and deeper, while repeating each image would go deeper into my brain, and I would do whatever he told me to do. Dr. Green moved on to wanting me to kill dolls that looked like real children.
Inquiry reports that resulted from these terrifying testimonies revealed one thing for certain. The experiments ended in disaster. In its insane quest for a robot human or a truth serum, the CIA failed. On August 3rd, 1995, with the revelations mounting up, then-President Bill Clinton makes a public apology. Since then, a great number of secret archives have been released to the public domain. Researchers would take an interest in this troubled period, notably Hank Alberelli, who worked on the suspicious death of Frank Olson, the biochemist who worked at the heart of the CIA. Since 1951, the year of the Pont-Saint-Esprit incident, Frank Olson called into question the ethics of the experiments being carried out and became depressed as a result. In November 1953, the CIA put LSD into his glass without him knowing. 9 days later, he threw himself off the 13th floor of a New York hotel. Murder or suicide, we'll never know. At the time of the investigation, Hank Alberelli found a surprising document coming from the White House. It surprisingly linked the name of Frank Olson to Pont Saint-Esprit. Why, in the middle of the Korean War, would the White House be interested in this small French village? Even better, Hank also came across a study carried out by the CIA on LSD.
The document itself was a comprehensive overview or history, if you will, of LSD specifically, yes. Not on ergot, had nothing to do with ergot. There was a section or chapter, if you will, headed incident at Pont Saint-Esprit. And the first two paragraphs of that describe essentially what we've all read, you know, many times over in terms of what happened at Pont Saint-Esprit. But the remainder of that section, the rest of that page, which was about half the page, and the two pages that followed, were completely blocked out.
Above all was this damning document from the CIA. It dates from 1953 and has no doubt been declassified by mistake. A director at Sandoz Laboratories confirmed to a secret agent that the Pont Saint-Esprit incident was caused by LSD. Sandoz Laboratories was where Albert Hoffman worked, the man who discovered LSD. It even claimed the drug was responsible for the Pont Saint-Esprit tragedy, before recanting. This same document states that in 1952, the source at the CIA had already explained that the cursed bread was caused by LSD. Did French authorities try to silence the affair? Several years after the drama, a head of the Victims Association was shocked at how disinterested the investigators were. Do the French have something to hide? We've interrogated former members of the Secret Services, investigated national and regional archives, as well as those from the police and the Justice Department. The files are hard to find, and many important pieces, such as reports from main hearings, have disappeared. If America revealed unwillingly some of its secrets about its participation in the poisoning, the uncertainties over the involvement of the French authorities may yet go on for some years longer. It takes 75 years for some sensitive documents to be made public. Hidden in its small streets and stone buildings, Le Pont Saint-Esprit drama has yet to reveal all its secrets.
Judging from the CIA's dark and notorious past of misconduct, perhaps it will be no surprise if horrific clandestine high-tech experiments are being carried out somewhere in the world by the CIA at this very moment. Secrets that we must wait 75 years to be declassified, if ever disclosed to the public at all. And that's everyone for this week on Aperture. It's goodbye.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.